All right, welcome. Tonight's class is on Parshas Noach. The title of the class is Harvey Weinstein, Mayim Bialik, and Parshas Noach. Three things that obviously go together, but by the end of the class, you'll say, yeah, they do go together. So we're going to catch everybody up. For those people who may have been living under a rock and have been unaware of what's happening, I'm going to give you a short little video catching everybody up with the Harvey Weinstein saga. So here we go to the videotape.
Weinstein's star is falling fast. Now more than 40 women, including some of the world's most famous stars, are accusing the disgraced Hollywood mogul of sexual misconduct or worse. The allegations stretching across international waters as the investigation grows. And now the president of France weighing in, saying he intends to strip Weinstein of the prestigious French Legion of Honor Award. This morning, the explosive allegations against Harvey Weinstein spreading beyond the U.S. Police in London are now investigating claims of sexual assault made by three women against the same man, reportedly Weinstein. Actress Lisette Anthony says Weinstein raped her in the 1980s. She says she reported Weinstein to the police days ago, telling the Sunday Times, "I was disgusted and embarrassed. I blamed myself. I've been an idiot to think he and I were just friends." More than 40 women have now made accusations against Harvey Weinstein, ranging from sexual harassment to assault to rape. Weinstein's spokesperson says any allegations of non-consensual sex are unequivocally denied by Mr. Weinstein.
"This is terrible. It's a terrible moment."
On Friday, model Angie Everhart told TMZ Weinstein touched himself inappropriately in front of her more than a decade ago during the Venice Film Festival.
"When I talked about it before, nobody listened. I'm glad that people are listening so that it doesn't happen anymore, because it's not okay."
And over the weekend, TMZ discovered a video of Courtney Love on the red carpet back in 2005, giving this warning.
"Do you have any advice for a young girl moving to Hollywood? Look at Love.
Love tweeting after the clip went viral on Saturday, "Although I wasn't one of his victims, I was eternally banned by CAA for speaking out against Harvey Weinstein." CAA refers to the Creative Artists Agency, a talent and sports agency. Meanwhile, at Variety's Power of Women luncheon Friday, contempt and validation.
All right, it goes on. You get the basic idea. So let's just review. So basically, the allegations are that Harvey Weinstein, the head of formerly Miramax and the Weinstein Company, basically used his power to force, aspiring actresses or actresses they wanted to get work in his, in Hollywood and through his as being a significant producer, they had to basically give him what he wanted sexually. That's the allegation in essence. All right. All right. So I have a question to you all. Now I go back to the sheet. Take it into the parsha. Why did Harvey Weinstein get away with his sexual predatory behavior for three decades?
It isn't a culture that permitted it.
What do you mean?
Hollywood studios tolerated this behavior, even if, and women were looked down upon.
What do you mean? Women are, I mean, everyone, every, women are looked down upon in all of Hollywood. That's a little bit, you have to have a little evidence for that.
It seemed like it was a little bit of quid pro quo. You give me what I want, I'll give you what you want, and then something went wrong, and now everybody's coming out.
Well, did the women really want to participate?
They didn't really, but it's a couple of layers. I know there's a, I don't know exactly, but we shouldn't be like alone with a man, even if they seem great or whatever, that you really don't know. But part of it seems like, I think speaking out would hurt their chances of making it. So that may have stopped a good number of these people.
So why did any of this, but apparently everybody knew this. Why did, apparently there were many multiple settlements paid by the company for women to not press charges, to let the situation go away. And there are people in the company that apparently knew all this. Why didn't anybody say anything or do anything?
He was such a bigwig and had so much power that I think there was a lot of fear.
Correct.
That, like Suzanne said, if you're an actress, you might never work again. Or if you work for his company, or he just was a man with just so much power that people felt like they had more to lose than to.
Yeah, he made a lot of people money.
What happened? Well, what, you know, he had just, he was so big.
Like, right. he was like a mocker. Like, people were, he was a big deal. So people were afraid that if they stepped up, you know.
Right. So, and also, so both things. A, if you're working for him and you're going to say anything, you're going to immediately get fired. And if you're an actress or an actor, you're worried not only will you not work for his company, but you'll get blacklisted from all the companies, and your entire dream of working in the movies will be crushed. And third, if you quote unquote tolerate his behavior, if you get along by going along, like Scott's saying, you might make money. So it's a carrot and stick situation. Since he's really calling all the shots, he's abusing his power. Because he has everybody there afraid of him, that he will take revenge against them, but allowing him to look the other way for his abusive behavior. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's real. It's like a little scary that all these people, that this is their dream. So many of them.
The 40 women that come out to
them, or anybody that colluded with him and kept it quiet. And I'm not trying to victim shame, but, you know, there are certain things we just know we shouldn't do.
All right, so we're going to get to that. We're going to circle back, because the controversy got more interesting, but a little more complicated, because Mayim Bialik, who identifies as being an observant woman, who, as you know, is in the, who's been an actress in Hollywood for, and, you know, movies and TV for years. She wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, and then she got a lot of backlash as well. We're going to get to that. But let's take it into the Parsha, and you'll see within 5 seconds how this connects to our Parsha, okay? So the Parsha begins with the ninth verse of the sixth chapter of Genesis, Bereshit. But in order to understand sort of the background story of the Parsha, you need to read the first 9 sentences. Without further ado, Samantha, read us the first couple of psukim.
Man began to increase on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them. The sons of the judges, nobles, saw that the daughters of man were good, and they took themselves wives from whoever they chose. God said, "My spirit will not continue to judge man forever, since he is nothing but flesh. His days shall be 120 years. The titans were on the earth in those days, and also later. The sons of the nobles had come to the daughters of man and had fathered them. The titans were the mightiest ones who ever existed, men of renown."
Okay, go on.
God saw that man's wickedness on earth was increasing. Every impulse of his innermost thought was only for evil all day long. God regretted that he had made man on earth, and he was pained to his very core. God said, "I will obliterate humanity that I have created from the face of the earth, man, livestock, land animals, and birds of the sky. I regret that I created them." But Noah found favor in God's eyes.
Okay, so what was the first event that precipitated this descent to the point that God regretted even creating man? What was the first thing that the Torah tells us started to do?
Sexual promiscuity.
But of a very specific kind. Not so much, that's true, but it's of a set of, how did it occur? It's very specific format.
The rich and powerful took all the women that they wanted, whoever they wanted.
So why does the terrorist specify that they did it? Why was it specifically that they did that? They took all the women, whoever they wanted.
Because they are the ones who have the most freedom and the most choices, and they're choosing to do these things that are wicked and that drive other people to.
What makes them wicked?
Coercion, slavery.
Right, so in other words, they are using their position, their power, you know, their influence to be able to abduct these women. That's why the terrorist specifies it was the sons of the nobles or the judges. Two possible, the word is B'nai Elohim, to be the sons of leaders or the sons of judges. But anyways, saw the women of man were good, and they took themselves wives from whoever they chose. Now, it seems on the surface, well, that's not terrible. So let's take a look at, and we're going to go back to Noach in a moment. Now, the commentator is Radak. Radak was a commentator, 12, 1300s, and he was from the grammatical school. Let's see what he has to say. Go ahead. So let me have Michael Dodes read us the son. Yeah.
Okay.
Commentator of the Radak, David Kimchi.
What does it mean, the sons of the judges or nobles? The elite of the species who are here referred to as Elohim, just as in Shemot, Elohim lo tiklal, you must not curse a judge. There are numerous similar examples in the Torah of the attribute Elohim being applied to morally high-ranking human beings. Unkelos also translated in this vein when he speaks of Rav.
B'nai Rav Ravaya means the sons of the nobles. Okay.
According to Bereshit Rabbah, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai cursed anyone who translated the words B'nai Elohim as the sons of God.
Right, so he wants to say, don't view it as being sons of God, okay? That's a mistake. But rather?
Yeah, that when the elite of the people are themselves guilty of the sins they want the common man to refrain from, their efforts are doomed to start with. Another reason offered by these people referred to as B'nai HaElohim.
Okay, so basically, there's a double, he brings up another dimension, Shimon ben Yochai, the famous Shimon ben Yochai, who is ascribed, traditionally ascribed to being the author of the Zohar. He says, don't translate the word B'nai Elohim as being the sons of God, you know, some sort of angelic beings. No, they were the elite, and they were doing, he makes the thing even worse. They were preaching one hand that everybody should be sexually modest, but what were they doing on the side, secretly? What were they doing secretly? What were they doing secretly?
They're involved in promiscuity.
Right, they're having these affairs. In other words, this is very, it happens all the time. Like in Washington, you'll have powerful congressmen and powerful senators and even presidents that use their influence to, shall we say, with young interns, right, and take advantage of them. And they do it what? In a hidden fashion, because typically these people are also officially married, right? And they're, of course, acting as being very good morally people, when in reality, they're having, numerous affairs, okay?
The Peshat seems to say that it seems pretty in the open, though.
So that's why the Shimon Yochai indicates that's his angle, correct. It says doesn't say they did it openly, just says they took any of them from wherever they wanted to. Now that, and it said the Benot Adam, the daughters of man. Let's take a look at this.
Should I read this, or?
Yeah, read.
Okay, Et Benot Adam, the daughters of the weaker specimen of the human race. The women were unable to resist the physically superior specimen referred to as B'nai HaElohim, and as a result, if fancied by the latter, they would be taken by them as wives or concubines against their will and the will of even their husbands. The Torah describes the first time the law of the survival of the fittest was practiced by the human race. The result was the Mabul, the flood.
That's the editor, okay, the translator of this. Okay, that's his. Editorial, it's a little editorial point. But now Radak makes a very interesting shot. So he breaks up down to two levels. You have the B'nai Elohim, which are on one hand higher ranking people, and B'nai Elohim are also what? Physically stronger, right? And the Adam are regular people, or what? You know, normally. So therefore, they have the ability to just simply take women forcefully. Okay, it's another angle. Go on.
The term Adam next to the term Elohim simply compares the weak to the strong in the Sifrei Behalotacha. The point is made that when ordinary individuals observe that the judges took the law into their own hands, they reason that they themselves would most certainly be able to get away with the same thing, seeing that the judges are supposed to set a good example.
Right, so so another way of translating Elohim versus Adam is the strong people versus the weaker people. So it could be two possibilities. Either they were politically, economically powerful, so they had way like a Harvey Weinstein. Oh, so you don't want to sleep with me? So fine. You just won't work in Hollywood. Your choice is yours. I'm not coercing you. It's as he's arguing, it's purely consensual. I'm not touching you. Right? But it is a force. It's an economic force. Or the second possibility, the Radak brings is another possibility, is that Elohim means these were physically, that's why you're talking about the giants or these giants, that they were physical, people who were physically more powerful, and they used their brute strength to abduct women. Okay, but there was, whatever your way you take it, it's still the same thing. All right. All right, and then we get to the PG-13 part of the Radak. Go ahead.
Okay. Ki tovot hine, that part.
Yeah, so to about Hena, they were attractive. Go on.
Rabbi Yudam, noting the defective spelling of the word tovot. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, tovot, but without the two vavs.
As tabat.
Well, it's like you say. Sometimes you read it as being what they call chaser, assuming the vavs are there. So you still say it's tovot, but you put a dot over the tet and the bet and the vet.
Still tovot.
Right. You would vocalize it as tovot, but it's missing two vavs. Okay, go on.
Claims that this is the transitive form of the verb and that the judges, when handing over the virgin bride to her prospective husband, would first sleep with her. The missing letters vav in the word tovot refer to these girls having been deprived of their hymen.
All right, so this of course, is I review Don. I think it's from the Tana or Amora typically recorded in the Jerusalem Talmud indicates, okay, I'm not going to go through the grammatical point here, but another level of sort of like further infliction of is that they would basically, this was Jews throughout history were victimized in this way. In fact, the famous Judith story in the time of the Hanukkah during the Maccabees time, all right, where the general would sleep with the women before they would be married. Are you familiar with that story? Are you familiar with the story of Judith? Judith?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, so basically, just for those who don't, Judith was a Jewish woman. She was getting married, and part of the oppression of the Syrian Greeks during the right prior to the story of the Hanukkah story with the uprising of the Maccabees, one of the ways that they oppressed the Jews was that the law was that the woman before her wedding night she had to sleep with the general, and then she went there and she got him tired and she chopped off his head. Okay, and so part of the celebration, you know, we say that women are obligated, even though that Hanukkah is a time-bound mitzvah. It only applies for 8 days of the year. And women should not really be obligated in lighting the menorah from a technical standpoint. But since Av Hein Hayu Ba'oso Anes, since they too were involved in the miracle, they were the agents of the miracle in the Yehudit story. So therefore, they now became obligated because they were the vehicle for the miracle. All right, one possibility. Another possibility, women are obligated in that because they also were the beneficiaries of the miracle. Anyways, it's ironic that Rav Yudan ascribing that practice to the B'nai Elohim gods. Okay, so basically what happens next? So what's the next play-by-play? So the first the elite are doing that. Well, then what happens?
Other people say, hey, they're having fun. They must approve it. Why not me?
Right. So why should I be so careful morally and sexually, and therefore became a sexual free-for-all? Okay, but then it gets worse. Let's go on. Let's read the rest. Let's get to the first five sukkim of the parsha. Let's have Samantha. These are the chronicles of Noah.
These are the chronicles of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, perfect in his generation. Noah walked with God. Noah fathered three sons, Shem, Ham, and Yepheth. The world was corrupt before God, and the land was filled with Hamas, robbery. God saw the world, and it was corrupted. All flesh had perverted its way on the earth. God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me. The world is filled with man's robbery. I will therefore destroy them with the earth.
Right, together with the earth. Okay, good. So let's take a little Rashi action. Okay, so read some Rashi there. Samantha, we've got a couple Rashis.
Verse 2, from whoever they choose.
Yeah.
Even a married woman, even males and animals.
Okay, so the Medrash that the Rashi quotes is that basically it was a full sexual revolution that there was no sexual barrier whatsoever. So whatever sexual interest came to the mind of, this is talking about the B'nai Elohim, the leaders, the noblemen, they took whatever they want. Okay? Then we go on to the whole people became corrupt. Go on.
Was corrupt is an expression of immorality and idolatry.
Right, so the Hebrew batisha chet, and it became corrupt, indicates throughout the rest of the Chumash, sexual immorality, and then also idolatry. Idolatry. Okay, as he quotes, and he quotes, then he brings a proof here. Okay, so fine. Let's go on.
And the earth became full of robbery, Hamas robbery, as it is said, end of the dishonest gain, which is in their hands.
Right, so we read in Jonah, in the book of Jonah, it says that the people of Nineveh were involved in Hamas, the trying to dishonest gain. So they did tshuva, they repented. The people of Nineveh, the Assyrian capital, their problem was also Hamas, but they did tshuva on it. All right, go on.
The end of all flesh, wherever you find promiscuity and idolatry, a chaos comes upon the world and kills both good and bad alike.
Okay, that's a very interesting statement. We're going to analyze that. And then we get the last little Rashi. We're rocking the Rashi tonight.
Wait, what?
We're rocking the Rashis tonight.
The earth has become full of robbery. Their verdict was sealed only because of robbery.
Okay, so that's very interesting. Okay, so let's take a look at some questions here. And then we're going to do some questions. Then we're going to go to Mayim Bialik. And then we're going to start, we'll be done by 9. Go on.
What am I reading? The questions?
Yeah, questions.
According to Rashi, what were the stages of the descent of the people?
Okay, so there's multiple stages here. What happened? What happened first?
Promiscuity.
Limited to whom?
The nobles.
Then what happened? What's the next thing?
Spread to other groups.
Then it became pervasive to the entire civilization, to the entire society. What else came to happen?
Then it spreads to the world.
Well, all the people. Okay. What else activity did they start getting involved in?
Idolatry and robbery.
Idolatry, then robbery. Okay. So a question we have to ask is, well, how are those phenomena causally linked? You know what I'm saying? The Torah seems to, is in a very short form, is giving you a stages of the descent of the humanity. How does one thing roll into the other one? Well, I think the first one's easy. There's promiscuity from the noblemen to the rest of civilization. How does that happen? That's pretty simple.
They set the example and everyone follows it.
Right, because basically in every area of our society, you always have, you know, in simple terms, you have the leaders and you got the followers. Like, for example, let me make a simple example. How many people determine fashion in America?
You want a specific number or just a ballpark?
Yeah, around about a number.
A few dozen, maybe.
I would even argue less. You're gonna have the great designers, you know, from France, typically of, you know, Yves Saint Laurent, Chanel, you know, whatever the very
high fashion.
Right, whatever the high fashion and the average fit. In other words, let's say there's gonna be 10, 20 designers that are gonna determine what women are gonna be wearing spring 2018, right?
Yeah, like Marquesa.
There you go. I don't know. I'm agreeing with you because I don't know. That's not a strength. I'll believe you.
That's Harvey Weinstein's wife.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Soon to be former wife. As
yes. I'm trying to slam her.
Don't play Lashonhara.
All right. Yeah. One thing you don't want to be, you don't want to be her. Yeah.
More than that, you don't want to be his kids.
Right. That's good. That's true.
That's because, what he really did.
Right, because the truth is she can get divorced and she can move on. That's their dad and whatever. Okay, true. All right, so my point being is that in America, in the Western world, you might have 10, 20, you know, basically fashion designers, and, you know, and then the rest of fashion is be determined by that fashion leadership, you know what I'm saying? You know, when it comes to electronics, you have Apple and you have, you know, Samsung, you know, and various, you know, and a few other players. So too, in American society, there's a few people who are the leaders, and oftentimes they're the followers, and that's it. So if the leadership goes bad, we're all doomed because we are deeply affected by our role models. Okay. All right.
Remember, Penny, can I ask a question?
You can.
Why is idolatry so seen in such a negative way if this is before the acknowledgement and acceptance of Hashem as the one God?
That is an excellent question. There's a long answer, but then I'll give you the short answer. The Rambam in the first chapter of the Laws of Idolatry talk about the history of idolatry. And basically, was Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava, did they believe in God? Did they know about the oneness of God? From the text.
Yes.
Yes, they did. So the world, the humanity that had the Tzelem Elohim had an awareness of God. And then, according to the oral law, their grandson, Enosh, started the descent into idolatry, and actually I've done classes on that. That's another multi-step. Over many generations, they fall, the humanity starts to fall into idolatry. And this is a time where, and so they're also being involved in idolatry as well. That's a short answer, but you know, that's the bottom line is, in the Rambam's history of idolatry, humanity, punctured by the first man, Adam, who's in the first account, you know, chapter 2, is talking to God, so has an awareness of God. So he doesn't believe in idolatry. Either does his children. His grandson starts to say, "Well, this is a little bit too abstract, and we're gonna relate to God's powerful. We're gonna pray to the Son because it's really God's." That is God's servant to help create the biosphere, because without the sun, there is no life on Earth. And it goes more step by step until they start worshiping stars, sun and stars on its own right. And the idea of God is forgotten. And only a few people like Noah know about it. So here we have a society that's involved in promiscuity and is involved in idolatry. So it's not clear how the idolatry comes in, but one thing is clear. How does the robbery, first of all, what is robbery? Gezel.
Seeing everything in the world is yours.
Well, I mean, from a halakhic standpoint, what is robbery versus theft? Gezel versus Geneva.
Taking it from someone with their knowledge versus trying to take it from someone without their knowledge.
Correct. Gezel is open robbery. You see a guy with a nice, an iPhone 10, you just grab it out of his hand and says, this phone is now mine. You know, like happens like, you know, like when little nerdy kids in like ninth grade come to school with a lunch and a big guy takes the guy's lunch. That's robbery. That's Gezel. All right. So how does Gezel come out of this? How does the Gezel taking other people's possessions in open, aggressive manner, how does that come out of such a society?
Survival of the fittest, domination. I see what you have, I want it, I take it.
What was the first thing they started with?
Taking the women, even if they were married.
Right, so they start off with a kind of gazelle of the women. And that extended to, if that's the person's prime relationship, well, I'm going to take everything. So why not take their house, their car, their jewelry, their gold, their silver, whatever. So it was a natural phenomenon.
But then when you say that, if you say the progression is women, idolatry, robbery, then wouldn't those robbery and women go closer together?
So the idolatry is a good question, how that fits in. Okay, so because Rashi says, since the term hishchit, hashchata, also refers to idolatry, he implied, one could argue the following. Here's the argument for that, for Rashi's position, that how are you going to tolerate a society which is filled with sexual immorality? How are you going to justify that? You have to create a belief system. In other words, a person can't view themselves being fundamentally an animal. In other words, whenever any person does a sin, when any of us does a sin, what do we have to do first? We have to craft a rationalization, okay? Our own psyche can't view ourselves being evil. So we have to say that, yes, this activity is bad, but in our circumstance, in my situation, it's okay. You know what I'm saying? We all need rationalizations. So if you have a society completely committed to, you know, promiscuity, you have to start to create a religion of materialism where the good of life is physical pleasure, hedonism. Well, that requires you have to live in a purely physical universe. So if there is a being who is outside the material world and represents a spiritual good, this is you can't tolerate that. So they have to deny his existence to be able to fully immerse into a hedonistic lifestyle. It's very hard to believe in a non-physical God while I'm personally indulging in hedonistic pleasure. You know what I'm saying? Guys, you hear that idea? In other words, there's the sexual, like there's the promiscuity, and there's the philosophy of justification around that. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because a person has to have the following affirmation: I am a good person. Well, how do I view myself as a good person when I'm sleeping around and I'm even taking women by force? How do I justify that? So I have to create a world where I have to create a vision of the universe, a metaphysics, if you will, that all there is physical enjoyment. It's like what they call Epicureanism. In other words, the goal of life is to have the very best physical satisfaction, because that's all there is to life. So what are you holding out for if that's all there is? So that pushes out the idea of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. So you have, in a certain sense, now you see Rashi on a deeper level. You see why he has to put the other idolatry in there. Because he has to create the theology that justifies this crazy behavior. We're not crazy. We're intelligent.
So at which point do these people go so far around the bend that they're beyond redemption?
Ah, so that's what Rashi says. When was the verdict of their destruction?
The robbery part?
Robbery. Now, of course, I may have discussed this even last year. I don't remember. So why was Rosh, we're skipping the last middle question, we'll go to the last question. Why was a verdict sealed only because of robbery? And I'll go back to question number two in a moment. What do you say, guys?
Because they knew it?
No, but let me ask the question another way. What's worse, idolatry or robbery?
You'd think idolatry.
They're both bad, just in different ways, right?
They are both bad. Now, for example, a Jewish person, if a person puts a gun to your head and says, I want you to go in and go into that liquor store and steal the money out of the cash register and put a gun to your head, what is the halacha? Do you do it?
You do it.
You do it. Yeah. Right. It's what they call Yavor v'al yara, v'al yehareg. You violate the mitzvah of robbery, the prohibition of robbery, to preserve your life. But when it comes to idolatry, a person puts a gun to your head and says, I want you to worship this idolatry, what do you have to do?
You're supposed to take the bullet.
You're supposed to take the bullet. There's three mitzvot, murder, incest, adultery, and idolatry, which a Jew has to demonstrate that life is not worth living if I have to violate these cardinal violations. Murder, idolatry, incest, adultery. Okay? But interesting, God did not view that the world should get drowned by the deluge, by the flood, until of robbery. Which, of course, begs the question is why? It's not the worst crime. Why is that being the one that's sort of like the straw of the camel's back?
I mean, society can't exist if there's robbery, because there's no like law and order, just total chaos.
Correct. I think we mentioned this last year, but Sean is correct, that even though that idolatry is worse, but as an environment of regrowth and regeneration, you cannot have a successful society if you have anarchy and robbery and the entire fabric of society is ripped to shreds. Because if you have prevalent robbery, that means everybody has to create their house as a fortress and nobody trusts each other. There is no cooperation. And basically it's completely, as Sean said, just complete lawlessness and chaos. Okay, which is a nice way to go back to the other statement of Rashi. Wherever you have promiscuity and idolatry, a chaos comes to the world and kills good and bad alike. In other words, there are many, when you have a social ill of this greatness, you have there are certain social problems that many people are unfortunately victimized. So just an expression of that. The fact that the Hollywood, which is now going through a process of tshuva, or at least they say, tolerated powerful men to abuse their position of power and victimize young women on the various casting couches. And this was like a known thing. Like this was called when people said, "I'm in Hollywood and I'm paying my dues." What did that really mean? Or if you're a model and you're paying your dues, what does that mean?
They're doing things they're not comfortable with to become successful in that or get a role or to get ahead.
So, Elise, you said in such a sneeze way. Doing things they're not comfortable to do. That is the right way to say that. But it means that they're sleeping with people or involved in sexual activities, which they feel violated. They're violating their personal dignity from engaging that just to promote their, you know, walking up the corporate ladder of that particular industry. So you, if that's the culture, everybody suffers, okay? So the society hurt everybody. You know, when you have an evil, there are many victims, unintended victims that are getting nailed. Okay, so well, this is a very good segue. So in the fray, about a week ago, Mayim Bialik writes an op-ed in the New York Times, and you can Google it and read it. This is from the Jewish Telegraph Association. Let's read. They wrote sort of a little synopsis. So let's have Sean read it out here.
All right. Actress Mayim Bialik has drawn criticism for an op-ed she wrote for the New York Times in response to the allegations of sexual assault and harassment against Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein. Although she wrote Saturday that she was, quote-unquote, shocked and disgusted by the accusations, critics charged that Bialik had suggested dressing and acting modestly is protection against the kind of behavior Weinstein is accused of. I have decided that my sexual self is best reserved for private situations with those I am most intimate with, she wrote. And then, I dress modestly, I don't act flirtatiously with men as a policy, end quote. Bialik, who is an observant Jew and a divorced mother of two young sons, added that while, quote unquote, absolutely nothing excuses men's sexual assault or abuse of women, quote, we can't be naive about the culture we live in. She noted that she took a long break from Hollywood to get a doctorate in neuroscience and admonished young women that, quote, having others celebrate your physical beauty is not the way to lead a meaningful life, end quote. The backlash was swift. Mashable internet reporter Chloe Bryan said that Bialik was insinuating that she had evaded harm because of her choices, that this was, quote, irresponsible and dangerous, end quote. Contrary to Bialik's implications, it's not just doe-eyed women with personal trainers who experienced harassment, Brian wrote Sunday. It's all of us.
Okay, so do you understand the argument? So what Mayim Bialik suggested, she made it very clear. She says, no matter how the woman is dressed, it's 100% wrong for a man to sexually assault a woman, whether she's dressed modestly or immodestly. But she said personally, as she, in her journey of Hollywood, she has taken the following position. She dresses modestly. She's not flirtatious. She's not she makes sure she's not alone with anybody. And then, of course, her fans got angry at her, saying, "Oh, you're blaming the victim." So, what do you guys? Let's weigh in on this machlekes here, this argument.
This reminds me of the criticism of Vice President Pence from the whole thing, where he said that he doesn't go out to dinner or have meetings alone with women, and then they blamed him for being like chauvinistic and not blame him for his impulses.
Absolutely, I saw these two things being compared. Also, Pence's decision and Mayim Bialik's, and I actually agreed with both of them.
So, what's the argument here?
You don't put that. Even though men shouldn't do what they're doing, at the same time, like, we as human beings know that you shouldn't put a stumbling block in front of somebody. Like, if they're not willing to control themselves, you do have to take precautions. It is true. You can't, just because you can doesn't mean you should. Just because you can walk around in a bikini all day does not mean that it's a healthy, normal thing to do. Yeah. Somebody's going to say something to you. It's just the way the world is.
All right, so you're strongly with the Mayim Bialik there.
1,000%.
1,000%. Okay. Anybody
Mayim Bialik makes like a good point, but dressing modestly and acting modestly and not, it's not going to save you all the time from sexual harassment.
Well, that's what they're saying. Correct. So there are other people.
It's not their fault. It's our fault.
Correct. So with the other, what Chloe is arguing, said, look, it's not just super hot models that get sexually harassed. It could be any woman, and whether she's dressed in a provocative manner or she's dressed in a modest, reserved manner. You know, she's saying it's all of us. Now, again, and there's a big campaign on the internet to hashtag what? Me Too. What is it called? The Me Too?
Me Too.
Yeah, Me Too. That if you yourself have, if a woman has felt that she has been sexually harassed, that she should show her solidarity with all the women, the actresses and models who are now coming out of the shadows and saying that we were in this industry, both Hollywood and the Hollywood of fashion and modeling, and we had to endure all these indignities. And it's not just us, but it's a regular woman working at a bank and at a law firm, at an insurance company, at a school, et cetera.
Yeah, but isn't that different?
Yeah.
I mean, don't we take things on a case-by-case basis? And I think Mayim Bialik made it pretty clear that, at least from, I don't know, the way I read it, interpreted that she wasn't saying that, you know, where was I going with this? More like, yes, everybody experiences it, but you want to do certain things that, you know, maybe lessen the chances a little bit.
Correct. So she would argue, in fact, I think she's going to put out another, I don't know if it's a video or whatever, explaining her position even more, or put into a, I think she's going to have a roundtable discussion to, because she asked, because now she got swept up into the whole argument, because everybody's all at her now. All right, whatever. But I think your point, Samantha, is very, very on point here, because both things are true. In other words, number one, yes, it is true that men can be creepy and inappropriate and even predatory and assault women who are not dressed in a provocative manner, not in women who are, quote, unquote, asking for it, okay? However, having said that, one could make the argument that if a person is doing certain behaviors without an awareness of the sexuality of mankind and the nature of our society, that's also asking with a measure of foolishness. So with that, I want to share a little Rambam with us so we can really, let's have some, or Samantha, since this is your, take a look at this particular piece. Dad.
Sages said, a person's soul, oh no. Wait, can you still hear me?
I do hear you.
Okay. Our sages said, a person's soul desires and craves theft and forbidden sexual relations.
All right, stop right there. So there's a core desire that mankind has. Taking stuff which isn't ours, you know, all right, doesn't mean we act on it. And B is sexual, forbidden sexual relations. That, so basically, this, the rabbi says, that's normal. Go on.
You will never find a community that does not have some people who are promiscuous regarding forbidden relationships and prohibited sexual conduct.
Okay, so that's a huge thing. I mean that in every Jewish community, since Moshe Rabbeinu until the time of the Mashiach, there are going to be some people who are going to be having affairs. Fact. It is no way, it cannot be legislated away. It is a reality. It's just a fact of life. Okay? Is that clear to everybody? Let's go on.
Moreover, our sages said, most people trespass with regard to theft, a minority with regard to forbidden sexual conduct, and all with regard to indirect gossip.
Right. So this interesting statement from the Talmud says that most people steal. Now, it means not the typical, like, wholesale larceny. It means like going to work and, you know, going to the supply closet and taking stuff, borrowing people's stuff without asking permission. You know, taking people's pens, you know, I don't think it means, you know, bank heists, you know, and, you know, grand theft and larceny.
stealing time at work from your employer.
You dial a lawyer, you're cheating a little bit on your taxes, you know, stuff like that. So most people are involved in that.
What about emotional theft?
Well, theft means really taking a physical object, taking control of a physical object of another without permission.
All right.
That, you can use theft in a much more poetic way, which you're pointing to. Minorities involved in forbidden sexual conduct, and everybody talks about what they call avak lashon hara. Indirect lashon hara means like, I don't get into that. It's a kind of a lashon hara. Lashon hara, like, for example, you go to a person who is, doesn't like the person, and you say, I want to say that Jen did a fantastic job. You know that person doesn't like Jen. You know that person is going to basically cause that person to fight and say, no, Jen's not good and she's a loser and she's not talented at all. In other words, you're causing lashon hara to be said. So we're all involved, at least in indirect lashon hara. Okay, let's go on. That's not the main point of the class, obviously, lashon hara. Keep on going.
Therefore, it is proper for a person to subjugate his natural inclination with regard to this matter and train himself in extra holiness, pure thought, and proper character traits so that he will be guarded against them. You should be very careful with regard to entering into privacy with women, for this is a great cause of transgression.
Okay, so this was actually mentioned initially by Suzanne. So the word, the Hebrew privacy with a woman is called yichud. Now notice, who is the halacha seeming to be focused more upon, the men or the women?
Men.
Because typically, in other words, in the news, when you have cases of sexual harassment. Now, there is sexual harassment of women to men. That does happen. But, I haven't done a study, but it seems to me that the lion's share of sexual harassment is men acting against women. What you hear about?
Yeah.
I mean, there are rare cases of a female supervisor that forces a man to, I don't know, sleep with her, but that's like, I think that's extremely rare. And maybe this, and it's so rare it becomes a subject of movies. So that's rare. But the main thing, that what they call the Garm HaGadol, the great cause, is Yichud. And all the cases of Harvey Weinstein, we're now going full circle on Harvey Weinstein. The situation of Harvey Weinstein was always the same, reading the New York Times, reading the other accounts, was the following. He said to a aspiring actress, yeah, let's get together, I'm going to be at the hotel, at the Cannes Festival. And lo and behold, the meeting was being held where? Where was the meeting being held?
His hotel room.
In his hotel room. Surprise! Right. So that if the woman was ascribing to the Jewish laws of sexual, I said, look, Mr. Weinstein, I'll be honored to meet with you, but I follow a strict protocol that I don't meet in any man's hotel room. Unless there is, I'm coming with another man. Now, again, he could have said to her, look, well, that's where I'm meeting. Too bad. You know what I mean? He could have said that. But I'm just saying, and I'm not blaming these women, but I'm just saying that the halacha of avoiding yichud really avoids a lot of the problems. So
the other side of yichud, though, is like the Mike Pence solution that we talked about a few months ago, of it gets to an extreme that you can end up excluding women from important conversations because of you don't want to be alone with them.
But that's not true. That's not what he did.
I don't want to derail, but
that's what people attacked him as. And he says, I'm not going to have meetings in my office with the women alone. Okay. I'm not going to go to dinner unless my wife is there. So you could have a meeting with a woman, a woman staff member, but he just can't be alone. Now, personally, I want to tell you something, that at MJE, we as the rabbis, we have pastoral sessions with women, but we all keep the door ajar, and always when there's other people, you know, who are on the same floor, you know, who are there. Because it's a problem of yichud. You can't be alone with a woman, even if you're there as a therapist or in a therapeutic or pastoral role. So, you know, so from a halakhic standpoint, it's forbidden. And from a good policy standpoint, it makes a lot of sense. So quite frankly, you know, a lot of these HR disasters that you read about always start off with like, you know, people are working late and suddenly this guy leaves and this person leaves and this and then all there is left in the floor is the guy and the girl. And then something happens, then it becomes a he said versus she said. It cannot be proved. The poor woman gets, attacked in some way that she did not want. And it's a disaster. So the best I would argue, I can make, you know, that nothing's 100%. A woman can be dressed modestly, avoid yichud, and she still could be sexually assaulted. True. But as Samantha pointed out, you can do things intelligently that will minimize the problem. And certainly, if our culture, in other words, you guys are a little bit younger than I am. Okay, you're a lot younger than I am. So, I even still remember at like my sort of like my early conscience of the 70s, there still were a lot of people living with a early 60s or mid 60s mentality, which was much more conservative. In America, if it was 1948, men and women did not, they had this, you know, there. I'm not saying it was perfect, but in general, people had a much more modest mentality, you know, coming from a Judeo-Christian perspective. So,
Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, has a famous story that he tells that when he came to Brandeis to try to get the Kraft, they wouldn't let him up to the door. Like, it was just so different.
Correct. In other words, I know this is going to sound crazy to people who went to college, you know, like in the last 10 or 15 years, but it used to be there was a woman's, even through the 70s even, if there was a woman's dormitory, there would be typically a person, you know, like a guy in, you know, a security person at the front, and you were not allowed to go upstairs. It used to be, in my lifetime, there was no such thing as co-ed dorms.
Just co-ed dorms today. It's like I went to a school where men and women were sharing the same bathroom.
Right.
Like walking around preparing for a shower.
Right. So we have an extreme. So unfortunately, in my opinion, our society has swung from, you know, super rigidity to a super permissiveness that, quoting Rashi's statement, which is a nice way of saying it, whenever you find promiscuity, a chaos comes to the world and kills both good and bad alike. In other words, you created no boundaries, no principles, and everything is okay. You're going to create a lot of unexpected, unintended social consequences. And whether we've talked about in classes, you know, the level of date rape in colleges, people drinking, and then having circumstance occur. Now, of course, the whole argument what the exact level is, but any amount is a problem. So the point of the matter is that to put into one neat treat, our parsha talks about how the story of the flood, the decree against humanity, started with the rich and the powerful abusing their power to take advantage of women. And I don't think we're in the same situation in our society, although from a healthy standpoint, for the first time in my recollection, I'm hearing the leadership of the Motion Picture Association of the Oscars that we need to change the culture. Now, that's words of tshuva, that we have a situation which is, you know, overly sexualized and is abusive of women, and we have to take steps to be able to protect women. Now, I don't think they're taking it further enough that maybe the fact that we have extreme, you know, sexuality and promiscuousness in general society, it's not been a good thing for America. And I remember a member of America that wasn't like this. So in my own lifetime, I've seen a tremendous descent, a hypersexualization, which is causing a lot of social ill. And the whole episode with abuse of power and sexual harassment is a consequence of that. And Judaism, on one hand, is not to deny it. We have to view ourselves. We are sexual beings, and we desire even forbidden sexual relations. There's nothing wrong with that. That's part of our makeup. Having said that, we have to be intelligent about how we present ourselves and govern ourselves. Certainly, the men and even women, and the key element, a major help in this process, really is the word of yichud, is avoiding being alone with somebody who's not your husband, brother, or your immediate blood relative. And to, you know, whether it be keeping the door open, whether it be making sure people are coming in and out, you know, I'm not going through all the laws of yichud, a little complicated, but in general, avoiding a circumstance where something unfortunate could occur. And unfortunately, the story of all these women was yichud gone bad. And these poor women were victimized in all kinds of ways, which we will, of course, hear about in all its glory, gory details in the next series of weeks, unfortunately. So that's but it's interesting that the entire descent of mankind into a purely animalistic state started by the leadership of using the power, which is the Harvey Weinsteins of their day. So it's interesting how, on one hand, the Torah is talking about an event that occurred thousands of years ago, but in reality, it's a scenario that we as a society are still struggling with today. Okay. Any questions? All right. Have a great night, guys. I'll see many of you on Wednesday.
Thank you.
Bye. Tomorrow. Bye.